feel.
National Security This Week, a weekly look at American national security issues. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, and you've joined us for National Security This Week. We get together every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security, and we're joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us explore American national security. Occasionally, we are joined by guests from around the world, and today is one of those days. Our guest today is on the air with us from Cairo, Egypt. I promised listeners at the very beginning of this show, way back on January 6th of 2021, that we'd cover issues of importance to American national security that likely don't get enough coverage in our press. We have such a show for you today. We're returning to the continent of Africa for our discussion today, and if you hear someone talk about the Nile River, you probably invariably think of Egypt and the fact Egyptian civilization for thousands of years has relied on the Nile River for every aspect of life. But the Nile River is massive, and the Nile River you think about flowing into the Mediterranean is actually the confluence of the Blue Nile and White Nile rivers, which come together near Khartoum, Sudan. With us to discuss the importance of the Nile River Basin on geopolitical issues in Northeast Africa is an expert in African history. Dr. Mark W. Dietz is Assistant Professor of African and World History at the American University in Cairo, Egypt. His research and teaching focus on 19th and 20th century West African history, especially in the Senegambian region. Dietz moved to Cairo in 2017 after obtaining his doctorate in African history at Cornell University. Dr. Dietz embarked on this academic career after retiring from the U.S. Marine Corps in 2010. During his time in the Marine Corps, Dietz flew helicopters, including Marine One, with the Presidential Helicopter Squadron, serving Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. Dietz spent much of his second decade of military service in the diplomatic corps, serving as the Marine and Defense Attaché to West African countries such as Senegal, the Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, Cape Verde, and Mauritania. Dr. Mark Dietz, welcome back to National Security This Week.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
You know, the amazing thing is you're over in Cairo, and we're on Zoom, and there is, I mean, it's like you might as well be across from me in the studio right now today. It's just a tremendous what technology gives us these days.
I hear you. It's so cool. It's amazing what we can do these days.
What's happening in Cairo? Any big news out of Cairo right now?
Well, yeah, there's some things that have kind of maintained their place in the news lately. In addition to this topic that we're going to talk about in relation to the dam in Ethiopia, Egypt is going to be hosting the COP27, which is the next climate change conference in Sharm El Sheikh. So there's actually a lot going on right now to get ready for that, including here at the American University in Cairo. We've had calls for proposals and different things like that for people to participate in that, in whether it's pedagogy or contributing research to that meeting. The other big news that, you know, kind of is getting, I think, a lot of people's attention is the construction of the new administrative capital, 45 kilometers east of Cairo, and how that's going to affect life in Cairo. So, you know, the same thing kind of happened when I was in Senegal. They built kind of a new capital in this area called Jamnagio, east of Dakar, and they built a new airport out there. That, you know, the idea is that eventually they're going to move the capital, and so they're kind of doing the same thing here in Egypt. So you can think of it as kind of similar to moving the capital from New York City to Washington, D.C., District of Columbia, when that happened. So there's that. That's been in the news quite a bit. And then, of course, like everybody around the world, I think there's been some concern about the effects of the war in Ukraine.
Yeah.
As Egypt, you know, which used to be a grain exporter, actually, to the Roman Empire. Egypt now imports 85% of its wheat from Ukraine and Russia.
Mm. So I have to imagine there's...
Yeah, people are... Like, I don't think it's a, I don't think it's a dire situation yet, but it's something to pay attention to. And so that's been in the news quite a bit as well here.
Yeah, I can imagine. So, Professor Mark Dietz, you were on the show with us earlier this year talking about West Africa and the coups, the coup d'etats that have been happening in West Africa. I've asked you back on the show today to discuss the Nile River Basin. You live and work in Cairo. Let's start our discussion today by talking about the historical importance of the Nile River to literally everyone who lives in Cairo. And I actually caught an article not too long ago, just September 14th, talking about the fact that there was an ancient branch of the Nile River that is gone now, long gone, that actually assisted the building of the pyramids of Giza. Going 4,500 years ago, the Nile River had an arm that allowed a lot of those supplies to build the the pyramids at Giza, and that part of the river is gone now. But let's talk about modern day, the importance of the Nile in Cairo itself.
Sure. Well, in Egypt, the Egyptians say that the Nile River is life. They basically equate the Nile River with life. And they equate it with Egypt. Without the Nile River, there is no Egypt. Mm. It's a desert country with a northern coastline on the Mediterranean and an eastern coastline on the Red Sea. And so the Nile, again, I mean, the whole country is a desert. The Nile is the only freshwater source for a country of over 100 million people. Mm. And about 99% of Egyptians live along the Nile River Valley. So it's pretty hard to overestimate the importance of the Nile River to Egypt, to Egyptian life, and to the Egyptian nation, the sense of national identity that's here. It's been that way since I teach a world history course, John. I'm getting ready tomorrow to lecture on some of the earliest river civilizations in the world. And one of those that we'll be talking about is, of course, here along the Nile. So it's kind of been that way since the start of the agricultural revolution. And this is one of the great river civilizations of antiquity, along with, Indian culture on the Indus River and Asian culture, Confucian culture along the Yangtze River. This is a big one. So, and by the way, since that time, there has been this sort of intermittent antagonism between Egypt and its upriver neighbors, yep, such as the ancient Sudanese kingdom of Kush and its descendants. So, I think it's almost impossible to overstate the importance of the river to Egypt and to Egyptians.
So 99% of the people in Egypt live along the Nile River. Do they pull water from the river to fertilize crops and whatnot? And then how do they handle?
Yes.
Do they pull water directly for drinking water? Do they treat it? What do they do with sewage from 100 million people? Does it go back into the Nile River? Does it get processed first? I mean, how do some of those things work?
Yeah, so it is the source for all of those things that you just mentioned. And, I think one of the things that's frightening so many Egyptians about the dam that we're going to talk about later in the show, the dam in Ethiopia, is that, we have these estimates for, I think it's like 1,000 cubic meters of water on a regular basis that human beings need to live. And if you look at what the effects of kind of the increasing population here in Egypt. So this is also a question of population density and the growing population here in Egypt, which has been growing like gangbusters over the course of the last several decades. The amount of water that's left for each individual is shrinking. And again, that's part of the concern. And the largest part of that, like you said, John, is actually for agriculture.
Okay.
Like the apportionment to each person. Of course, we all need fresh water to live. We all need that to drink and to live. But the largest portion, the largest concern is the effect on agriculture. And so the amount of food that's going to be able to be produced for each person. So all of the agriculture that's here, and obviously it's not enough since they're importing so much grain from the Ukraine, but the agriculture that's here is all along the river. It's all along the banks of the river or the delta up there, to the north near Alexandria.
And isn't that where a lot of the Egyptian cotton is grown is up there? And that's a big export product for Egypt.
Right. Yeah, that was a big export product that was really central to early Egyptian development. Sounds like some of your Egyptian history under the guy who was kind of considered the father of modern Egypt, Muhammad Ali. Not the boxer that we all of us Americans think of, but actually, one of the governors. He was an Ottoman governor who became kind of independent in some ways, a certain amount of independence from the Ottoman Empire, and really kind of formed this nation into the country that it is today. And he did that with a lot of the development in cotton, and especially after the American Civil War. So what I'm talking about is the importance of that to international trade, because that helps explain why Britain became so interested in colonizing Egypt in the late 1800s.
Yeah, and so you're a student and teacher of history. How big of an impact was the United Kingdom on the development of the economy in Egypt, even to the modern day?
Yeah, well, it's huge. I mean, it's very important. I mean, Great Britain is going to use the cause of abolition of the slave trade to help justify its colonial conquest of a number of parts of East Africa, but especially in Egypt, and so they're going to actually bombard the port of Alexandria, this one of the most ancient ports in the world, here on the southern Mediterranean, and then occupy Egypt in 1882. That becomes an important part of the logic for British colonialism in this part of the world, and then will eventually lead to Egypt becoming a colony of Great Britain. But Egyptians are very proud at the same time that they've never really, they never adopted English as the official language of Egypt. It's always been Arabic. And to some extent, Egypt is also different among the kind of African, colonized African countries. Because it's known as the colonized colonizer because it had already been colonized by the Ottomans. It was part of the Ottoman Empire. And then there's this sort of joint Anglo-Egyptian condominium that is ruling over Egypt and the Sudan in the 1800s. And the Egyptians are actually the ones who kind of colonized Sudan originally, before the British come in and take over in the late 1890s.
Yeah, it's interesting. And again, you know, because you're a student of history, both of us were history majors at the Naval Academy, so I guess we benefit from that sharing that similarity. But if you look the history of Egypt and the British involvement there, you just mentioned the efforts on the part of the British to stamp out the slave trade. Up in the Sudanese area of Africa, that slave trade was very strong. And so their move to push Egypt and, you know, their partners in Egypt to move up the Nile to combat the slave trade was pretty significant. We have, you know, the ill-fated expedition on the part of General Gordon.
Right.
Which didn't turn out too well for him. A typical British military disaster in Khartoum. You know, all of those things lead us to start talking about, I guess, we should maybe discuss what happens or how big the Nile River really is. Give our listeners a better sense of the scale of the Nile. Can you talk a little bit about kind of where the Nile River begins, the two major branches, perhaps?
Yeah, sure. So what we consider the Nile River proper, you're right. I mean, that basically starts in Khartoum, where the Blue Nile and the White Nile come together. And we're going to be focusing mostly today on the Blue Nile and talking about these issues with Ethiopia. And we know the source of the Blue Nile. It's Lake Tana. In Ethiopia, but in the case of the White Nile, we don't actually know. So usually when you read about the source of the White Nile River, you're going to read something that says like Central Africa or the Great Lakes region of Africa. Older sources would say something like Lake Victoria. But believe it or not, with all of our modern technology, John, we don't have a specific geographical location that we can identify as the absolute source for the White Nile in the Great Lakes region. But it's by most people is considered the longest river in the world at 4,100 miles long. And so, you know, just to put that in perspective for your listeners, the Mississippi River is 3,902 miles. So the Nile River hasn't beat by, 200 miles here. There's also in between those two, actually the Mississippi is the fourth longest river in the world. In between them are the Amazon River and then the Yangtze River. So the Nile is the longest. And like I said, it originates at the confluence of the Blue Nile and the White Nile in Khartoum, which is the capital of Sudan, the country just to the south of Egypt. And but the Nile River system, you know, with all of its tributaries and everything, runs through 10 different African countries in Northeast Africa and Central Africa. And cooperation between those countries varies widely, let's say.
For our audience, this is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. Mark Dietz, who teaches at the American University in Cairo, Egypt. Today, we're discussing the importance of the Nile River Basin in regional affairs in Northeast Africa. Professor Dietz, we mentioned it. Let's talk about the city of Khartoum. What role has it played in the geopolitical history of that region in Africa?
Well, it's, as such an important geostrategic location at the confluence between the White Nile, the Blue Nile, and the White Nile. It's played a very important role in the history of Sudan and Egypt to some extent, and certainly as the capital of Sudan for quite some time. The city was actually founded in 1821, and this is at the time that basically Egypt was becoming the colonizer of Sudan. But it's also very close to, you know, you mentioned Charles Gordon, that British colonialist who was beheaded and, you know, slaughtered by the forces of the Mahdi, who was this Islamic savior who was going to come to save the world. That took place but even later then, there's going to be the Battle of Omdurman. And the Battle of Omdurman actually is a very lopsided victory for British colonial forces against the forces of the Mahdi. The Battle of Omdurman is very close to where Khartoum is. It's going to become the capital then of the Sudan, administered by this joint Anglo-Egyptian province that was a legacy of imperial compromise between the Ottomans. Like I said, technically Egypt was still part of the Ottoman Empire, though with increasing independence from the start of the reign of Muhammad Ali and the British. And so, it becomes the colonial capital, and then it remains as the post-colonial capital of Sudan once Sudan gets its independence from British rule in 1956.
And Khartoum itself today in modern day, 2022, how important is it as a kind of a regional hub economically for that portion of Africa?
Well, it's very important as the capital, and also as there's still an incredible amount of traffic going up and down that river, and both of those at the confluence, and then both of those branches, the Blue Nile and the White Nile, until you start getting to the area of the rapids. Which is the area that often presented such a challenge to explorers to get beyond those rapids to go further up the White Nile. So it's an important transportation link, and it has been a very important sort of political and military location for quite some time. There's been a lot of unrest there lately. As you know, if you've followed the news in the last 3 or 4 years, you know, there've been issues and the long time dictator Bashir was finally overthrown. And so, you know, they've had a transitional government for quite some time, but it's still a country that faces a lot of challenges. As you know, South Sudan used to be a part of Sudan. Mm-hmm. South Sudan became independent after a referendum in 2011. Now Sudan, Northern Sudan, if you will, is trying to find its own way, and yet it still faces all of these divisions from ethnic divisions in the country, which have played an important role throughout its history. Really,
let's talk about those two branches of the Nile River, and maybe we should start with the White Nile. You mentioned earlier, from a geographic perspective, we're still, even with modern technology, not exactly sure where the start of the White Nile River is. It probably is impacted heavily by when the tropical rains come through every year, and, you know, which basins of water get filled up more than the other, and where they start flowing to the north along the White Nile. Can you talk a little bit about the White Nile's geopolitical importance in Central Africa? I mean, it's up in that Great Lakes region. It flows north from there, the White Nile does. We've got the Democratic Republic of Congo. You've got Uganda. You mentioned just a minute ago South Sudan. They all figure prominently in the White Nile's meandering path. Even Rwanda, Burundi, and Tanzania are important nations at the headwaters of the White Nile. What's happening in that region of Africa these days, and what role does the White Nile play in the geopolitics of the Central Lakes region? Maybe the river itself isn't the important part. It's really the competition for control of other resources that it just happens to be along the White Nile.
Yeah, well, it's an area of incredibly rich resources to some extent. And again, to put on my historian's hat, I teach this world history course going back thousands and thousands of years. And we've talked about early human development, the Great Rift Valley of Eastern Africa. And all of this, that valley basically starts with the Nile River Valley, and it flows south. It goes through all of these Great Lakes regions down into Southern Africa. And it's really incredible. And so in many ways, the geopolitics of Northeast Africa and of Eastern Africa start with the Great Rift Valley. Mm. And what you see as the White Nile meanders along to the north is that it's moving from lake to lake to lake. You have all of these various lakes. And of course, Lake Victoria is the largest, but you also have Lake Albert and others to the north. And then eventually you get to Lake No in South Sudan. And all of these are linked together by the White Nile. And so, this has been in some ways kind of at the center of human existence for hundreds of thousands of years. And it's still an incredibly rich area. And, this isn't exactly tied to the Nile River, but I think one of the most revolutionary things in our lives is the fact that we're all carrying around these smartphones in our pockets.
Yep.
And the fact that, we were being amazed by the technology that's allowing me to talk to you right now from halfway across the world through these laptops. And all of these things are powered by these lithium batteries that come from these mines in the Congo. With little kids who are risking their lives to go down into these mines to dig out the cobalt and things like that that are going to be used to form these batteries. So, that's an important link to our lives, because we all have these smartphones in our pockets or in our purses or whatever the case may be. Of course, the region has certainly known horrible conflict over the last few decades.
Yeah.
We think of the Rwandan genocide in 1994, and then, of course, what follows after that with the Congolese civil war that basically runs from 1996 until 2003, and 5 million people dead. 5 million people, John.
Oh,
I mean, I don't know how many Americans are aware that there was such a war in Central Africa. And again, this is not tied directly to the geopolitics of the Nile River, but that's the region that this river is coming from. So, like I said earlier, even with all of these great explorers from the Victorian age in the late 19th century, like Henry Morton Stanley and Dr. David Livingstone, you have the famous statement from Livingstone to Stanley, or no, from Stanley to Livingstone when he found him, right? He was looking for him. He found him on the shore of Lake Tanganyika and said, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume." But even all of these intrepid explorers could not pin down the exact location of the source, which I think has given it this, eventually this kind of sacred character that we mere mortals were not destined to know, even with all of our advanced satellite technology. The closest we can come is somewhere up in the highlands between Rwanda and Burundi. Yeah. Somewhere up there is the source of the Nile.
Yeah, that area of Central Africa, the Central Lakes region, is there's still a lot we don't know about everything that's in there. The species that live there, we're still, I mean, explorers are still discovering new species. There's aspects of the rainforests that are in there that might be very valuable from a medicinal perspective. You mentioned the mining that goes on. Not all of it is legal. The illegal logging that might take place of those forests. It's just it's a very difficult place to know and understand because it is still so remote from a transportation access perspective. It's hard to get in there.
Absolutely. And it's easier to get in there in general. It's been easier to get in there anyway from East Africa, mm-hmm. from kind of the angle of East Africa and Northeast Africa, just because there was a little more colonial development in that area. But one of the tragedies of our Cold War support for Mobutu in Congo was that, I mean, he was so corrupt, he took all the U.S. defense assistance and everything that we gave him and, did things like buying the Condor, the aircraft, buying a new jet and buying a chateau in France and all of these kinds of things, and really did nothing to build the infrastructure, to build roads, to build railroads, to build river transportation technology in the Congo. So they're still dealing, unfortunately, with the effects and the legacy not only of colonialism, but also of some of these ruthless, brutal dictators of the post-colonial Cold War era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actions have consequences and repercussions, right? So it's sort of third and fourth order negative impacts of the things that we're trying to do in the near term. Mark, if we could, let's flow north along the White Nile back up to Khartoum. And then take our listeners on a bit of a journey up the Blue Nile River to explore the Ethiopian highlands. Can you tell our listeners about the Blue Nile River?
Yeah, sure. So like I said, the Blue Nile originates from Lake Tana in Ethiopia, which is kind of in northwest Ethiopia. And it runs for 900 miles. Until it meets up with the White Nile in Khartoum. And so, like I said, though it's not as long as the White Nile, the Blue Nile actually provides over 80%. I believe it's about 85% of the water that moves downstream from Khartoum. Is actually coming from the Blue Nile. And believe it or not, supposedly the way that these rivers got their names was from the sediment that they carry coming from the Ethiopian highlands, like Blue Nile does, with some of the rocks and soil and stuff like that. It eventually turned the water this kind of blue color, whereas the White Nile has a lot of clay, had a lot of clay coming from the Central Africa area. Okay. And so quite often all of that clay content in the White Nile actually turned the water white. So your listeners may have suspected that there were other reasons for naming them the Blue Nile, the White Nile, but it's actually those are the colors that they are. So anyway, again, over 80% of the water that's moving downstream from Khartoum, it's coming from the Blue Nile. Obviously, it's very important to Ethiopia as a freshwater source there, and also to Sudan, and then of course to Egypt, with all of these areas that lie downstream from there. So the geostrategic importance of the Blue Nile really, it can't be overstated. I mean, it's hugely important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I understand it, up in the Ethiopian highlands every year, the annual rainfall that happens up there is pretty significant. And during the yeah. rainy season, the pulse of the river is supported by that rainfall that happens up in the Ethiopian highlands. And there's a tremendous amount of water that comes down from the highlands along the Blue Nile River to make its way, those 900 miles to the city of Khartoum in Sudan to marry up with the White Nile. And so Egypt, Cairo, where you sit at the end of the, almost at the end of the Nile River, everything that happens in Egypt, all 100 million people who survive on the water from the Nile River, depend completely on the rainfall that's happening in the Ethiopian highlands a few thousand miles away.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And I've personally experienced that rainfall. I've been to Ethiopia three times, to Addis Ababa, and a couple times during the rainy season. And, they don't have four seasons. They have two seasons. It's the rainy season and the dry season. And during the rainy season, yeah, it rains cats and dogs, man. It really does.
Yeah. Lake Tana fills up, starts overflowing the banks, and you get this tremendous wash down the Blue Nile River. And interestingly yes. enough, Ethiopia, which I'm sure you know, has had a heck of a lot of upheaval. Lots of different yes. wars going on amongst different ethnic groups in the nation of Ethiopia. I know you're more of a West African historian, but can you talk a little bit about the strife that's happening in Ethiopia itself?
Yeah, no, it's been a huge area of concern, partly from a humanitarian standpoint, because of this this conflict with the Tigrayan rebels in the northern part of the country. It's wild because for quite some time there was an alliance between the Tigrayans and the Amharans. Most people in Ethiopia speak Amharic. And by the way, the largest Ethiopian community outside of Ethiopia, last I knew, was actually in the greater Washington, D.C. area. Mm. Ethiopia claims to be the birthplace of coffee. So quite often you'll find in any coffee shops in the Washington, D.C. area, you'll probably find some Ethiopians there. What's been going on is really tragic. And, it's also sort of ironic because before he started this war, the prime minister of Ethiopia, Abiy Ahmed, had won the Nobel Peace Prize for finally bringing about peace with Eritrea.
Right.
It's the longtime enemy of Ethiopia. He finally brought about peace with them, and then eventually, there's this uprising from the Tigrayan region to the north, which is also pretty closely tied with Eritrea. But, again, ethnicity plays a role here because the Tigrayans and the northern Ethiopians were in power for quite some time in Addis Ababa. But Prime Minister Abiy is from the Oromo ethnic group in the southern part of the country. And so, it's hard for people to see the attacks of the Ethiopian army on these Tigrayans to the north and not see that in ethnic terms.
Yeah. Yeah, it is just a flat-out tragedy, everything that's happening in Ethiopia itself. And the country is rich in resources. I mean, water especially,
yeah.
Tremendous resources. For our audience, this is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. Mark Dietz, who teaches at the American University in Cairo, Egypt. And we're discussing the importance of the Nile River Basin in regional affairs in Northeast Africa. So, Professor Dietz, you've painted a really fantastic picture for us of both the White and Blue Nile Rivers, which come together in Khartoum to form the main Nile River that flows through Cairo, where you live. The Nile is a massive river, both for its importance as a source of water and for life, for the length of its banks, but also for the geopolitical role the river plays in the entire region. So I'd like to go back to Ethiopia, and I want to bring up what I think is one of the most controversial things that's happening along the entire Nile River, and this is specifically the Blue Nile. Ethiopia, they have been working diligently to create power resources for their nation, and they recently completed the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, or the GERD, as it is often referred to. You live in Cairo and likely listen to Egyptian political leaders and news reports every day. How often does the issue of the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam come up in Egyptian politics? And what are the concerns that people have in Sudan about the GERD? I recently saw that the GERD is starting to fill, but it will take years for that dam to completely fill. And it will provide a tremendous amount of hydroelectric power for Ethiopia and the highlands region as well once it's fully operating. But it's going to impact how much water continues to flow downstream to support life, human beings and everything else, agriculture, you name it, but also the native wildlife in Sudan and in Egypt. What are you hearing from politicians in Egypt these days on this issue?
Well, you're absolutely right, John, that it's a huge issue here, and it comes up quite a bit in the news. And in fact, I would say maybe once a month I'm reading something about it. And, you know, the latest things are about the continual filling of these reservoirs that Ethiopia is continuing to do. And although the Egyptians have said a lot of really threatening things about that, at the end of the day, there's not a whole lot they can do to stop it. We can talk about that more in a minute, but unless they're going to use force, there's not a whole lot they can do about it. And Ethiopia, to this point, has seemed very intent and very focused on filling it up basically as fast as they want. They have been involved in talks. There have been a number of talks, some of them brokered by the UN, some of them brokered by the U.S. government, by the U.S. administration. And this, by the way, this was not a Democratic or Republican thing. This actually began with the Trump administration and continued into the Biden administration, with the U.S. trying to play this kind of mediator role among these three countries. So Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia. But so far, Ethiopia continues to, you know, they finished the completion of the dam around 2020, and then began filling it. There's basically two separate reservoirs that they're filling, and so this has brought a lot of tension to the region. Again, like I said, for Egyptians, the Nile River is life.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a direct threat to them. You know, the President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who's the president of Egypt, actually said that for Egypt, this is a matter of life and death. I think I have the exact quote here. He said, "No one can compromise Egypt's water. It is a matter of life and death."
Yeah.
So that just gives you a sense of how seriously they take this issue in Egypt. And there's also a certain amount of, you know, kind of a cynical view of what has happened here, because the Ethiopians began construction of the dam in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was going on in Egypt in 2011?
Right.
The revolution, right?
Yep, yep.
So from 2011 to 2013, you've got the Egyptian revolution. And that's the point at which the Ethiopians began construction on the dam. And so you can see why Egyptians view this as like a very cynical move while they're distracted with, you know, in dealing with their own revolution and dealing with the Arab Spring and all of the fallout from that. Ethiopia started this thing and started construction of this dam.
Yeah.
And the Ethiopians had been talking about it for years and years. And, you know, before he left power, before he was removed from power in the Egyptian revolution, apparently Mubarak had said, over my dead body.
Yeah.
You know, you will not construct a dam in Ethiopia. So that's one interpretation of history, right? Yeah. That as soon as they removed him, the Ethiopians began construction. I mean, I think that's a little too cynical in some ways. It would take a little more time, a little more planning to get all of the construction equipment into place and all of the financing and all of that to actually begin at that point. But, you know, it's one of those things in history, like we talk about, you remember this, John, you're a history major. We talk about the difference between causation and correlation.
Right.
I'm not sure that we can make an argument for causation here, but there's certainly a rather disturbing correlation. And that's certainly the way Egyptians view it. So it was in April of 2011. So that year that Ethiopia made this announcement that they were going to construct this dam, and it's costing $5 billion.
Yeah. And who's covering the cost of that, by the way?
So the vast majority of that is being paid for by the Republic of China.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Yes, exactly. To the tune of about $4.2 billion of the five. The rest is being raised through crowdfunding among Ethiopians and among the Ethiopian diaspora. And so you'll see at rallies and demonstrations in Ethiopia, there are all these T-shirts and all of these banners that say, "It's my dam." Because the Ethiopians literally have a stake. A lot of them have a personal stake.
Yeah,
they've actually contributed their money for this dam. Now, the majority is coming from, you know, Exim Bank in China. The Ethiopians claim that this is their dam because a lot of them have contributed to this. And they have a lot of reasons for doing that. It's estimated that 68% of the country in Ethiopia is without electricity.
Yeah, that's a huge percentage.
This hydroelectric dam, in one fell swoop, is not only going to solve that, and not only being able to provide electricity for every single Ethiopian who wants it, or, you know, who can afford it, but actually Ethiopia is going to be able to export energy from this dam. So this is the largest infrastructure development project on the African continent, John. It's huge, and you can tell that the stakes are also enormous.
Yeah. And I will just highlight this. You mentioned a little while ago that you're teaching this course on world history and the development of major civilizations along some of these, you know, huge rivers, these really lengthy river
right.
systems, the importance of these river systems. Let's just think through this for a minute. We're creating this massive Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. It will provide a tremendous amount of power, as you just mentioned, electrifying all of Ethiopia if the people want it. It's kind of like the American Rural Electrification Project that we did many decades ago.
Yeah.
But it relies completely on hydroelectric, and it relies heavily on a continuous supply of rains in the Ethiopian highlands. Now, we've seen a mega drought hit the western United States. It's impacting the Colorado River system, which impacts the Hoover Dam. We've seen the same kinds of things hit the Mekong River that flows through Southeast Asia. We actually did a show on the Mekong River a number of months ago. China has been impacted by drought, impacting their river systems. What happens when people become reliant on hydroelectric power in Ethiopia and the weather patterns change because of climate change and suddenly they don't get these massive rainstorms in the Ethiopian highlands that recharge Lake Tana and flow 80% of the Nile River down the Blue Nile to link up with the rest of the Nile? Where does the water come from to support 100 million people in Egypt who rely so heavily on the steady flow of water coming down the Blue Nile? I guess this is where I ask you, as a retired officer in the Marine Corps, somebody who studied history as your undergraduate major, earned a doctorate in history, and you served as a military diplomat in half of your career. What concerns do you have about geopolitical stability along the Nile River Basin in coming years, especially with the potential impacts of climate change?
Well, I have a great deal of concern. I mean, I hope that this is going to be something maybe that they'll talk about, these various diplomats officials at the COP27 summit in Sharm el-Sheikh. But yeah, I think this is a huge problem. This is the sticking point, John. What Egypt would, first of all, most Egyptians don't deny the right of Ethiopia to develop their country.
Okay.
And they don't, you know, of course, a very important infrastructure project for Egypt in the 1960s was the construction of the Aswan Dam.
Yeah.
Under Nasser, right? So the most Egyptians that I've talked to, they don't have a problem with Ethiopia building the dam in the first place. But what they have a problem with is how quickly they want to fill it up.
Yeah.
And so really that has been the crux of the argument here. That's one thing. And then the other thing is kind of the safety valve, you know, the complications that could arise from a few years of low rainfalls, a few years of drought. What is going to happen then? And with the effects of climate change, nobody knows for sure. We haven't seen that for sure here. So, you know, I was talking about the dwindling availability of water supply per person in Egypt, and I was tying that mostly to population growth, mm-hmm. not necessarily to reduced rainfall. But if we begin to see that, whether it's because of climate change or maybe just a bad turn in the weather, then I think that's going to be a really important potential flashpoint or decision point where, the Egyptian government and the Ethiopian government, the Sudanese government are going to have to make a call in how to work this out. And so how much control will Ethiopia give to these other two countries of its sovereignty, right?
Yeah.
Like it's there. So it's going to be Ethiopia's dam. How much control are they going to give to these other countries? And so consequently, we haven't seen the development of an international river management regional body like we have with some of the other rivers in the African continent, like the Senegal River in West Africa or the Ovambo River in Southern Africa. And the reason is because Ethiopia doesn't want anybody telling them how to manage this dam, how much water they have to release or not. And of course, they're trying to reassure the Egyptians and the Sudanese that they're going to be good neighbors, and that if there is a drought, of course they'll release more water. But there are no guarantees, and so Egypt has been trying to get some guarantees, and they haven't been able to work that out yet. The thing that I think we have going for us, all of us who are living in this region right now, is that I don't think either Egypt or Ethiopia wants a war.
Yeah.
They do a lot of saber rattling. That's a part of the diplomacy, you know, to kind of threaten with the stick. But I don't think either side actually wants to do it. And I think there are actually some questions about the capability of the Egyptian Air Force to carry out the kinds of strikes that would need to be carried out to take out the dam anyway.
Yeah.
First of all, it's not the neighboring country. You know, you got right. Sudan in between.
Yeah, that's right.
And like Egypt's closest air base would be, you know, there at Aswan. And so it's still like over 1,000 kilometers, well over 1,000 kilometers. So to get to that point. So that's one of the things that I think we have going for us in this situation is that I don't think anybody wants to see a war here. And for the United States of America, it's even a trickier question in some ways because both of these countries are very strong allies
yep.
of ours yep. in the region. Egypt is a very important ally, and so is Ethiopia. Ethiopia has been a strong ally, one of the strongest allies of the United States since the start of the Cold War, and you know, we used to have an Omega navigation station in what's now Eritrea, but then it was a part of Ethiopia. And so we have, and again, we've got this huge diaspora, Ethiopian diaspora in America, and a huge Egyptian diaspora in America too. So again, it's not really in anybody's interest to go to war. And so I think we have that going for us, but you know, every once in a while, these leaders, they have to threaten each other.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows where that could go? Who knows where that could lead?
So Dr. Mark Dietz,
I think the situation bears watching.
Yeah, you have painted a great picture for us overall of the entire situation on the Nile River Basin and both the White Nile and the Blue Nile and the importance of both those tributaries into the main Nile River that flows all the way to Cairo and north into the Mediterranean. This is why we study international relations, right, Mark? And why we take a look at history and try to figure out ways to make sure we don't make the mistakes of history as we move forward in international relations. Dr. Mark Dietz, thank you so much for joining us for the past hour. This has been a great discussion. I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure to be with you, John. Thanks.
And what courses are you teaching this term at the American University in Cairo?
Yeah, so I've got that world history course, and then I'm also teaching an African survey course. It's called Africa to 1830, where we're talking about basically pre-colonial African history.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm teaching a new course. This is pretty excited about this one. I'm teaching a course with my colleague from the political science department, Sean Lee. The course is called, it's an upper level seminar called the History and Politics of Civil Wars.
Mm.
You know, he looks at it as a political scientist and I look at it as a historian. And we try to bring out some of those disciplinary distinctions and hopefully the students will benefit. So far, it's been a lot of fun.
All right. Dr. Mark Dietz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, John. It's been a pleasure.
And folks, that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. I look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week. Have a great finish to your week, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly show looking into issues of American national security with the host, John Olson. Listen every Wednesday at 9 a.m. for National Security This Week.
This is Carlos Correa, shortstop for the Minnesota Twins. If you're looking for your next vehicle, stop